It is so much beyond anything I deserve. Mr. Elton, who might marry anybody.
My dear Harriet, you and Mr. Elton are by situation called together. You belong to one another by every circumstance of your respective homes. Your marrying will be equal to the match at Randall's. There does seem to be something in the air of Hartfield which gives love exactly the right direction and sends it into the very channel where it ought to flow.
That Mr. Elton should really be in love with me. Me, of all people, who did not know him to speak to him at Michaelmas. And he, the very handsomest man that ever was, and a man that everybody looks up to, quite like Mr. Knightley. Ah, oh, this charade. If I had studied a 12-month, I could never have made anything like it. It is one thing to have good sense in a common way, like everybody else, and to write a letter and say just what you must, and another to write verses and charades like this. But how shall I ever be able to return the paper? Or say I found it out? Oh, Miss Woodhouse, what can we do about that?
Leave it to me. You do nothing. He will be here this evening, I dare say, and then I will give it him back, and some nonsense or other will pass between us, and you shall not be committed. Your soft eyes shall choose their own time for beaming. Trust to me.
But what a pity that I must not write this beautiful charade into my book. I am sure I have not got one half so good.
Leave out the last two lines, and there is no reason why you should not write it into your book.
Oh, but those two lines are...
The best of all. Granted, for private enjoyment, and keep them for that purpose. But take them away from the public version, and all appropriation ceases, while a very pretty, gallant charade remains, fit for any collection. Depend upon it, he would not like to have his charade slighted much better than his passion. Give me the book. I will write it down, and then there can be no possible reflection on you.
Emma transcribed the charade, speaking aloud the lines as she did so, to Harriet's renewed blushes and exclamations. When Mr. Woodhouse joined them and inquired, as he frequently did, whether they had anything fresh for their book, Emma read the charade aloud, to Harriet's deep embarrassment, despite making no reference to its author. Mr. Woodhouse very soon led the subject to Isabella's visit, which was but a week away.
Have you thought, my dear, where you shall put her, and what room there will be for the children?
Yes, of course, Papa. She will have her own room, the room she always has, and there is the nursery for the children, just as usual. Why should there be any change?
I do not know, my dear, but it is so long since she was here. Such a pity she is coming for only 1 week. There will not be time for anything.
We ought to be thankful that they will be spending their whole time with us, that 2 or 3 days are not to be taken out for the Abbey. Mr. Knightley promises to give up his claim to his brother and family this Christmas, though you know it is longer since they were with him than with us.
It would be very hard indeed, my dear, if poor Isabella were to be anywhere but at Hartfield.
Harriet, you must give us as much of your company as you can while my brother and sister are here. I am sure you will be pleased with the children. We are very proud of the children, are not we, Papa?
Indeed we are. They are very fond of being at Hartfield, Harriet.
I dare say they are, sir. I am sure I do not know who is not.
They are all remarkably clever, and they have so many pretty ways, though I do think their father is too rough with them very often.
He appears rough to you because you are so very gentle yourself. He wishes his boys to be active and hardy, and if they misbehave, can give them a sharp word now and then. But he is an affectionate father.
And then their uncle comes in and tosses them up to the ceiling in a very frightful way.
But they like it, Papa. There is nothing they like so much.
Well, I cannot understand it.
That is the case with us all, Papa. One half of the world cannot understand the pleasures of the other.
Later in the morning, the hero of the inimitable charade walked in again. Harriet turned away, but Emma could receive him with the usual smile, and her quick eye soon discerned that he was conscious of having thrown a die, and she imagined he was come to see how it might turn up. His ostensible reason, however, was to ask whether Mr. Woodhouse's party could be made up in the evening without him. The matter was soon resolved, and Mr. Elton's absence excused. He seemed then about to make his bow when Emma took his paper from the table.
Oh, here is the charade you were so obliging as to leave with us. Thank you for the sight of it. We admired it so much that I have ventured to write it into Miss Smith's collection. Your friend will not take it amiss, I hope. Of course, I have not transcribed beyond the first 8 lines.
I see. Is this the book?
Yes. Do look at your charade written there. Harriet was so kind as to let me transcribe it.
I have no hesitation in saying, no hesitation whatever in saying, at least if my friend feels at all as I do. I have not the smallest doubt that could he see his little effusion honoured as I see it, he would consider it as the proudest moment of his life.
After this speech, he was gone as soon as possible. Emma could not think it too soon, for with all his good and agreeable qualities, there was a sort of parade in his speeches which was very apt to incline her to laugh. She ran away to indulge the inclination, leaving the tender and the sublime of pleasure to Harriet's share. Though now the middle of December, there had yet been no weather to prevent the young ladies from tolerably regular exercise, and on the morrow, Emma had a charitable visit to pay to a poor, sick family who lived a little way out of Highbury. Their road to this detached cottage was down Vicarage Lane, which contained the blessed abode of Mr. Elton. A few inferior dwellings were first to be passed, and then, about a quarter of a mile down the lane, rose the vicarage. There could be no possibility of the two friends passing it without a slackened pace and observing eye.
There it is. There go you and your riddle book one of these days.
Oh, what a sweet house! How very beautiful it is.
It was an old and not very good house, almost as close to the road as it could be, with no advantage of situation. Harriet, she found, had never in her life been inside the vicarage, and her curiosity to see it was so extreme that, considering its uninspiring exterior, Emma could only class it as a proof of love equal to Mr. Elton's seeing ready wit in Harriet.
I wish we could contrive a visit, but I cannot think of any tolerable pretense for going in. No servant that I want to inquire about of his housekeeper. No message from my father. Come, let us be on our way.
I do so wonder, Miss Woodhouse, that you should not be married or going to be married, so charming as you are.
My being charming, Harriet, is not quite enough to induce me to marry. I must find other people charming, one other person at least. I have very little intention of ever marrying at all.
Ah, so you say, but I cannot believe it.
I must see somebody very superior to anyone I have seen yet to be tempted. Mr. Elton, you know, is out of the question, and I do not wish to see any such person. I would rather not be tempted, since I cannot really change for the better. If I were to marry, I must expect to repent it.
Dear me, it is so odd to hear a woman talk so.
I have none of the usual inducements of women to marry. Were I to fall in love, indeed, it would be a different thing. But I never have been in love. It is not my way or my nature, and I do not think I ever shall. And without love, I am sure I should be a fool to change such a situation as mine. Fortune I do not want. Employment I do not want. Consequence I do not want. I believe few married women are half as much mistress of their husband's house as I am of Hartfield. And never, never could I expect to be so truly beloved and important, so always first and always right in any man's eye as I am in my father's.
But then, to be an old maid at last, like Miss Bates.
If I thought I should ever be like Miss Bates, so silly, so satisfied, so undistinguishing, I would marry tomorrow. But between us, I am convinced there never can be any likeness, except in being unmarried.
But still, you will be an old maid, and that's so dreadful.
The world believes that always to be a sour fate, Harriet, one that makes women illiberal and cross. This does not apply, however, to Miss Bates. She is too good-natured and too silly to suit me, but in general she is very much to the taste of everybody, though single and though poor. I shall not be in want of fortune in any case, nor of employment. Mine is an active, busy mind, with a great many independent resources. If I draw less, I shall read more. If I give up music, I shall take to carpet work. And as for objects of interest,
objects for the affections, the want of which is really the great evil to be avoided in not marrying, I shall be very well off with caring about all the children of a sister I love so much. There will be enough of them, in all probability, to supply every sort of sensation that declining life can need. My nephews and nieces, I shall often have a niece with me.
Do you know Miss Bates's niece? I know you must have seen her 100 times, but are you acquainted?
Oh, yes. We are always forced to be acquainted whenever she comes to Highbury. Heaven forbid that I should ever bore people half so much about all the Knightleys together as Miss Bates does about Jane Fairfax. Every letter from her is read 40 times over, and if she does but knit a pair of garters for her grandmother, one hears of nothing else for a month. I wish Jane Fairfax very well, but she tires me to death.
They were now approaching the cottage, and all idle topics were superseded. Emma was very compassionate, and the distresses of the poor were as sure of relief from her personal attention and kindness, her counsel and her patience, as from her purse. In the present instance, it was sickness and poverty together which she came to visit, and after remaining there as long as she could give comfort or advice, she quitted the cottage with such an impression of the scene as engaged her and Harriet in heartfelt discussion of the merits of such work. They walked on, fully engaged in their talk, until they passed a bend in the lane, and Mr. Elton was immediately in sight. The wants and sufferings of the poor family were the first subject on meeting. He had been going to call on them. His visit he would now defer, but they had a very interesting parley about what could be done and should be done. Mr. Elton then turned back to accompany them. To fall in with each other on such an errand as this, thought Emma, to meet in a charitable scheme, this will bring a great increase of love on each side. I should not wonder if it were to bring on the declaration. It must if I were not here. I wish I were anywhere else. She stopped soon after, under pretense of having some alteration to make in the lacing of her half-boot, and begged them to have the goodness to walk on, and she would follow in half a minute. They did as they were desired, and she lingered over her lace. When she was obliged to join them again, they walked on together quietly till within view of the vicarage, when a sudden resolution of at least getting Harriet into the house made Emma again find something very much amiss about her boot and fall behind to arrange it once more. She then broke the lace off short, and dexterously throwing it into a ditch, was presently obliged to entreat them to stop.
You must forgive me. Part of my lace is gone, and I do not know how I am to contrive. I really am a most troublesome companion to you both. Mr. Elton, I must beg leave to stop at your house and ask your housekeeper for a bit of riband or string, or anything, just to keep my boot on.
Mr. Elton looked all happiness at this proposition, and nothing could exceed his alertness and attention in conducting them into his house. The room they were taken into was the one he chiefly occupied, and Emma passed into an adjoining room with the housekeeper to receive her assistance. She was obliged to leave the door ajar, as she found it, but by engaging the housekeeper in incessant conversation, she hoped to make it practicable for him to choose his own subject in the adjoining room. For 10 minutes, she could hear nothing but herself. It could be protracted no longer. She was then obliged to be finished and make her appearance. He had been most agreeable, most delightful. He had told Harriet that he had seen them go by and had purposely followed them. Other little gallantries and allusions had been dropped, but nothing serious. Emma remained firm in her belief, however, that each such meeting must be leading them forward to the great event. Mr. Elton must now be left to himself. It was no longer in Emma's power to superintend his happiness or quicken his measures. The coming of her sister's family became henceforth her prime object of interest. She hardly wished to have more leisure for the lovers. There are people who the more you do for them, the less they will do for themselves. Mr. and Mrs. John Knightley, their 5 children and a competent number of nursery maids all reached Hartfield in safety. The bustle and joy of such an arrival, the many to be talked to, welcomed, encouraged, and variously dispersed, produced a noise and confusion which Mr. Woodhouse's nerves could not have borne under any other cause. The ways of Hartfield and the feelings of her father were so respected by Mrs. John Knightley that the children were never allowed to be long a disturbance to him. Mrs. John Knightley was a pretty, elegant little woman of gentle, quiet manners and a disposition remarkably amiable and affectionate. A devoted wife, a doting mother, and most tenderly attached to her father and sister. She could never see a fault in any of them. She was not a woman of strong understanding or any quickness, and with this resemblance of her father, she inherited also much of his constitution, was delicate in her own health and over-careful of that of her children. Mr. John Knightley was a tall, gentlemanlike and very clever man, rising in his profession and respectable in his private character, but with reserved manners and capable of being sometimes out of humour. He had all the clearness and quickness of mind which Isabella wanted, and he could sometimes act an ungracious or say a severe thing. He was not a great favourite with Emma. She was quick in feeling the little injuries to Isabella, which Isabella never felt herself, and there was a want of respectful forbearance towards her father, which nothing could have compensated for. Mr. Woodhouse's peculiarities and fidgetiness were sometimes provoking him to a rational remonstrance or sharp retort, equally ill-bestowed. It did not often happen, for Mr. John Knightley had really a great regard for his father-in-law and generally a strong sense of what was due to him. But it was too often for Emma's charity. The beginning, however, of every visit displayed none but the properest feelings. They had not been long seated and composed when Mr. Woodhouse, with a melancholy shake of the head and a sigh, called his daughter's attention to the sad change at Hartfield since she had been there last.
"Isabella, my dear, you have heard of poor Miss Taylor, I suppose. It is a grievous business."
"Oh, yes, sir. How you must miss her, and dear Emma too. What a dreadful loss to you both. I have been so grieved for you. And do you see her, sir, tolerably often?"
"Not near so often, my dear, as I could wish."
"Oh, Papa, if you speak in that melancholy way, you will be giving Isabella a false idea of us all. Every day, excepting one, have we seen either Mr. Weston or Mrs. Weston, and generally both, either at Randall's or here. As you may suppose, Isabella, they are most frequently here. They are very, very kind in their visits."
"Why, to be sure, I cannot deny that Mrs. Weston, poor Mrs. Weston, does come and see us pretty often, but then she is always obliged to go away again."
"It would be very hard upon Mr. Weston if she did not, Papa."
"I think there is nothing Mr. Weston does not deserve. I believe he is one of the very best-tempered men that ever existed. I shall never forget his flying Henry's kite for him that very windy day last Easter. If anybody can deserve him, it must be Miss Taylor. Do not you think so, John?"
"Indeed I do. And where, pray tell, is Mr. Frank Churchill?"
"He has not been here yet. There was a strong expectation of his coming soon after the marriage, but it ended in nothing, and I have not heard him mentioned lately."
"But you should tell them of the letter, my dear. He wrote a letter to poor Mrs. Weston to congratulate her, and a very proper, handsome letter it was."
"How very pleasing and proper of him."
Such convivial talk continued, and while the visiting family retired to prepare for dinner, Emma began to look for the arrival of Mr. Knightley, who was to dine with them. Besides the consideration of what was due to each brother, she had particular pleasure from the circumstance of the late disagreement between Mr. Knightley and herself in procuring him the proper invitation. She hoped they might now forget that they had ever quarrelled, for making up would not do. She certainly had not been in the wrong, and he would never own that he had. She hoped it might assist the restoration of friendship if she had little Emma, the youngest of the children, with her when he came into the room. It did assist, for though he arrived with grave looks and short questions, he was soon led on to talk of them all in the usual way, and to take the child out of her arms with all the unceremoniousness of perfect amity. Emma felt they were friends again, and the conviction giving her at first great satisfaction, and then a little sauciness as he was admiring the baby.
"What a comfort it is that we think alike about our nephews and nieces."
"If you were as plain and sensible in your estimate of men and women as you are with these children, we might always think alike."
"To be sure, our discordances must always arise from my being in the wrong."
Yes, and reason good. I was 16 years old when you were born.
A material difference then, and no doubt you were much my superior in judgment at that period of our lives. But does not the lapse of 1 and 20 years bring our understandings a good deal nearer?
Yes, a good deal nearer.
But still not near enough to give me a chance of being right, if we think differently.
I have still the advantage of you by 16 years' experience. Now come, my dear Emma, let us be friends and say no more about it. Tell your aunt, little Emma, tell her that she ought to set you a better example than to be renewing old grievances, and that if she were not wrong before, she is now.
That's true. Very true. Little Emma, grow up a better woman than your aunt. Be infinitely cleverer and not half so conceited.
Oh, dear me. Isabella! Isabella, I believe you are wanted.
I shall take her.
Hush now. Shush.
Now, Mr. Knightley, a word or two more and I shall have done. As far as good intentions went, we were both right. And I must say that no effects on my side of the argument have yet proved wrong. I only want to know that Mr. Martin is not very bitterly disappointed.
A man cannot be more so.
Oh, indeed, I am very sorry.
Can you now consider our friendship fully restored?
I can, and I am most glad of it. Look, here is your dear brother.
John, how are you?
How do you do, George?
The brothers greeted each other in the true English style, burying under a calmness that seemed all but indifference the real attachment which would have led either of them, if requisite, to do everything for the good of the other. The evening was quiet and conversable. The brothers talked of their own concerns and pursuits, most often points of the law or the home farm at Donwell. News of the family or of their mutual friends occupied the rest of the party, and the evening passed to the satisfaction of all. There could hardly be a happier creature in the world than Mrs. John Knightley in this short visit to Hartfield, going about every morning among her old acquaintance with her 5 children, then talking over what she had done every evening with her father and sister. It was a delightful visit, perfect in being much too short. On Christmas Eve, they were all to dine at Randall's. Harriet, Mr. Elton and Mr. Knightley, their own especial set, were the only persons invited to meet them. The evening before this great event, for it was a very great event that Mr. Woodhouse should dine out on the 24th of December, Harriet had gone home, indisposed with a cold. Emma called on her the next day and found her doom already signed with regard to Randall's. She was very feverish and had a bad sore throat. Far too ill, she readily admitted, for the delightful engagement, though she could not speak of her loss without many tears. Emma sat with her as long as she could, and left her at last tolerably comfortable in the sweet dependence of Mr. Elton having a most comfortless visit, and of their all missing her very much. She had not advanced many yards from Mrs. Goddard's door when she was met by Mr. Elton himself, evidently coming towards it, and they walked on slowly together in conversation about the invalid, of whom he had been going to inquire. They were soon overtaken by Mr. John Knightley, returning from the daily visit to Donwell with his 2 eldest boys, whose healthy, glowing faces showed all the benefit of a country run, and seemed to ensure a quick dispatch of the roast mutton and rice pudding they were hastening home for. They joined company and proceeded together, Emma describing the nature of her friend's complaint, and Mr. Elton looking all alarm.
a sore throat? I hope not infectious. I hope not of a putrid, infectious sort. Has Perry seen her? Indeed, you should take care of yourself as well as of your friend. Let me entreat you to run no risks, most especially in such cold weather.
Indeed. It does feel so very much like snow. And if it were to any other place or with any other party, I should really try not to go out today. Yet I know it would be so great a disappointment to Mr. and Mrs. Weston. But upon my word, Mr. Elton, in your case, I should certainly excuse myself. You appear to me a little hoarse already, and I think it would be no more than common prudence to stay at home and take care of yourself tonight.
Well, yes. It is very cold. Certainly very cold.
You do quite right. We will make your apologies to Mr. and Mrs. Weston. You might inquire after Harriet this evening, since we cannot.
Mr. Elton, if the weather is your only objection, why do not you take a seat in my carriage this evening? We should not like to do without your company unless it were truly unavoidable.
Thank you, Mr. Knightley. Such a kind and generous offer. You have restored a pleasure of the highest order. I cannot thank you enough. I shall join you after all, Miss Woodhouse, and all is right with the world. Ah, here our paths diverge. You to Hartfield, I to the vicarage. I assure you, Miss Woodhouse, that I shall call at Mrs. Goddard's for news of your fair friend, Miss Smith, before I have the happiness of meeting you again. I hope I shall have a better report. Good evening, Miss Woodhouse. Mr. Knightley.
This is most strange, thought Emma. After I had got him off so well, to choose to go into company and leave Harriet ill behind. Most strange indeed. But a dinner engagement is so high in the class of men's pleasures that anything gives way to it, and this must be the case with Mr. Elton. What a strange thing love is. He can see ready wit in Harriet, but he will not dine alone for her. When Mr. Elton had disappeared from sight, John Knightley turned to Emma with a gentle smile.
I never in my life saw a man more intent on being agreeable than Mr. Elton. It is downright labour to him where ladies are concerned. With men, he can be rational and unaffected, but when he has ladies to please, every feature works.
Mr. Elton's manners are not perfect, but where there is a wish to please, one ought to overlook. And one does overlook a great deal. Yet there is such perfect good temper and good will in Mr. Elton as one cannot but value.
Yes, he seems to have a great deal of good will towards you.
Me? Are you imagining me to be Mr. Elton's object?
Such an imagination has crossed me, I own, Emma. And if it never occurred to you before, you may as well take it into consideration now.
Mr. Elton in love with me? What an idea.
I do not say it is so. But you will do well to consider whether it is so or not, and to regulate your behaviour accordingly. I think your manners to him encouraging. I speak as a friend, Emma. You had better look about you and ascertain what you do and what you mean to do.
I thank you, but I assure you, you are quite mistaken. Mr. Elton and I are very good friends, and nothing more.
Two carriages conveyed the guests to Randall's that evening. Mr. Woodhouse and Isabella took the first, Emma and John Knightley the second. The cold was severe, and by the time the second carriage was in motion, a few flakes of snow were finding their way down, and the sky appeared so overcharged as to want only a milder air to produce a very white world in a very short time. Emma soon found that her companion was not in the happiest humour. Since the going abroad in such weather, with the sacrifice of time with his children after dinner, were evils which Mr. John Knightley did not by any means like. The whole of their drive to the vicarage was spent by him in expressing his discontent. Emma could not be complying, and yet she dreaded being quarrelsome. Her heroism reached only to silence. They arrived, the carriage turned, and the step was let down. Mr. Elton was with them instantly, and Emma thought, with pleasure, of some change of subject.
It is so very kind of you to send the carriage my way, Mr. Knightley. It would be very much appreciated at any time, but on such a cold evening as this, enough thanks cannot be expressed. What fine company for Christmas Eve.
Perhaps you have not heard, Mr. Elton, that Harriet is still unwell. Mrs. Goddard sent me word earlier today that she is no better.
Oh, I was on the point of telling you that when I called at Mrs. Goddard's door, which I did the very last thing before I returned to dress, I was told that Miss Smith was not better. By no means better, rather worse.
I was very much grieved and concerned, but I had flattered myself that she must be better after such a cordial visit as I knew you had given her this morning.
My visit was of use to the nervous part of her complaint, I hope, but not even I can charm away a sore throat. Such a sad loss to our party today.
Oh, dreadful. Exactly so indeed. She will be missed every moment. What an excellent device. The use of a sheepskin for carriages. How very comfortable they make it. Impossible to feel cold with such precautions. It is a very cold afternoon, but in this carriage we know nothing of the matter. Snows a little, I see.
Yes, and I think we shall have a good deal of it.
Christmas weather. Quite seasonable, and extremely fortunate we may think ourselves that it did not begin yesterday and prevent this day's party, which it may very possibly have done. Mr. Woodhouse would have hardly ventured had there been much snow on the ground. But now it is of no consequence. This is quite the season indeed for friendly meetings. At Christmas, everybody invites their friends about them, and people think little of even the worst weather. I was snowed up at a friend's house once for a week. Nothing could be pleasanter. I went for only one night and could not get away till that very day se'night.
I cannot wish to be snowed up a week at Randall's.
Oh, but we are sure of excellent fires and everything in the greatest comfort. Charming people, Mr. and Mrs. Weston. Mrs. Weston, indeed, is very much beyond praise, and he is exactly what one values. So hospitable and so fond of society. It will be a small party, but where small parties are select, they are perhaps the most agreeable of any. I cannot but think the evening promises great enjoyment.
My first enjoyment will be to find myself safe at Hartfield again.
Such a journey could not be counted an enjoyable one by Emma, caught as she was between Mr. Knightley's ill humour and Mr. Elton's excessively cheerful countenance. It was a great relief to her when they reached the house and were ushered into the company of the Westons, in which she found real enjoyment. She determined to think as little as possible of the oddities of Mr. Elton's very good humour in Harriet's absence, or of anything else unpleasant, and enjoy all that was enjoyable to the utmost. She was rather sorry, therefore, when Mr. Elton found a seat next to her at the first pause in her conversation with Mrs. Weston. His insensibility to Harriet's suffering was all too clear. He not only sat at her elbow, all obligation and cheerfulness, but solicitously addressed her upon every occasion. His behaviour was such that she could not avoid questioning whether he was beginning to transfer his affections from Harriet to her. If it were the truth, it was an absurd and insufferable truth. And yet for her own sake she could not be rude to him. And for Harriet's, in the hope that all would yet turn out right, she was even positively civil. But it was an effort, especially as something was going on amongst the others in the most overpowering period of Mr. Elton's nonsense, which she particularly wished to listen to. She heard enough to know that Mr. Weston was giving some information about his son. She heard the words, "my son," and "Frank," repeated several times over. But before she could quiet Mr. Elton, the subject was so completely past that any reviving question from her would have been awkward. Now, it so happened that in spite of Emma's resolution of never marrying, there was something in the name, in the idea of Mr. Frank Churchill, which always interested her. She had frequently thought that if she were to marry, he was the very person to suit her in age, character, and condition. She had a great curiosity to see him, and with such sensations, Mr. Elton's civilities were dreadfully ill-timed. But when, at last, she was happily released from Mr. Elton and seated by Mr. Weston at dinner, he soon returned to the subject she had longed to hear of.
Did you hear that we are expecting Frank? I had a letter from him this morning, and he will be with us within a fortnight. He's been wanting to come to us ever since September. Every letter has been full of it. But he cannot command his own time. Now, however, I have no doubt of seeing him here about the second week in January.
What a very great pleasure it will be to you.
And Mrs. Weston is so anxious to be acquainted with him that she must be almost as happy as yourself.
Yes, she would be. But that she thinks there will be another put off. The case, you see, is... But this is quite between ourselves. The case is that a party of friends are invited to pay a visit at Enscombe in January, and that Frank's coming here depends upon their being put off. If they are not put off, he cannot stir. But I know they will, because Mrs. Churchill always puts that party off when it comes to the point. I have not the smallest doubt of the issue.
Emma liked the subject so well that she began upon it to Mrs. Weston very soon after their moving into the drawing room.
My dear Mrs. Weston, I have been discussing a certain visitor with your good husband, Mr. Frank Churchill.
And I dare say Mr. Weston has been telling you exactly how the matter stands.
Yes, it seems to depend upon nothing but the ill humour of Mrs. Churchill, which I imagine to be the most certain thing in the world.
My Emma. Well, to you, I may venture on the truth. Mrs. Churchill rules at Enscombe, and is a very odd-tempered woman. And Frank's coming in January depends upon her being willing to spare him. But I am sure there is a great wish on the Churchills to keep him to themselves. They are jealous people. Jealous even of Frank's regard for his father.
He ought to come. Even if he could stay only a couple of days, he ought to come. And one can hardly conceive a young man's not having it in his power to do as much as that. A young woman, if she falls into bad hands, may be teased and kept at a distance from those she wants to be with. But one cannot comprehend a young man's being under such restraint that he cannot spend a week with his father if he likes it.
My dearest Emma, you must let it go its own way. But we must speak no more of it. Here come the gentlemen.
Thank you so much, Mr. Woodhouse. Excuse me, Mr. Knightley. Miss Woodhouse. Mrs. Weston, might I join you on the sofa? So kind. Mrs. Weston, you and your good husband are so hospitable, quite unexceptionable. I was saying so in the carriage, was I not, Miss Woodhouse?
Yes, indeed.
Miss Woodhouse, I am most anxious about your fair friend, your fair, lovely, amiable friend, Miss Smith. A bad sore throat is such an evil.
I quite agree. I do hope she is not suffering too badly tonight. We are all the poorer for not having her with us. I will visit her in the morning and hope a good night's sleep has restored her a little.
But, my dear Miss Woodhouse, you must not be blind to the dangers of the situation. A sore throat is infectious, and another visit to the patient would only double the danger you have already been exposed to. Pray do not visit the sick chamber until Mr. Perry has assured you it is quite safe to do so, and the infection is fully over with.
Emma tried to laugh it off and bring the subject back into its proper course, but there was no putting an end to his extreme solicitude about her. She was vexed. It did appear, there was no concealing it, exactly like the pretense of being in love with her instead of Harriet, an inconstancy, if real, so contemptible and abominable that she had difficulty in behaving with temper. He then implored Mrs. Weston to add her persuasions to his, assuming to himself the right of first interest in her. Emma was too much provoked and offended to say anything to the purpose. She could only give him a look, but it was such a look as she thought must restore him to his senses, and then left the sofa, removing to a seat by her sister and giving Isabella all her attention. She had not time to know how Mr. Elton took the reproof, so rapidly did another subject succeed. For Mr. John Knightley now came into the room from examining the weather, telling them of the ground being covered with snow and of its being still snowing fast with a strong, drifting wind. Poor Mr. Woodhouse was silent from consternation, but everybody else had something to say. Everybody was either surprised or not surprised, and had some question to ask or some comfort to offer. Mrs. Weston and Emma tried earnestly to cheer Mr. Woodhouse and turn his attention from his son-in-law, who was pursuing his triumph rather unfeelingly.
I admired your resolution very much, sir, in venturing out in such weather, for of course you saw there would be snow very soon. I dare say we shall get home very well. Another hour or two's snow can hardly make the road impassable, and we are two carriages. If one is blown over in the bleak part of the common field, there will be the other at hand. I dare say we shall be all safe at Hartfield before midnight. I hope so, for Mr. Weston's sake.
Ah, my sake? I am not to be thought of. Besides, there is no need to cause alarm over such a dusting. There is nothing that will impede your return, though I wish for my sake the road were impassable with snow, so that we could keep you all here.
What is to be done, my dear Emma? What is to be done?
Do not fret, Papa. James is an excellent driver. The horses will be fresh, and we are surrounded by good friends who will assist us.
Isabella, my dear, what think you?
I can only think of the children, Papa. I could not bear to be blocked up here while they are at Hartfield. I hope you shall excuse us, Mr. Weston, in hurrying home.
Yeah, but of course, you must do whatever is most comfortable.
John, my love, you had better order the carriage. I dare say we shall be able to get along if we set off directly. And if we do come to anything very bad, I can get out and walk. I am not at all afraid. I should not mind walking half the way. I could change my shoes, you know, the moment I got home. And it is not the sort of thing that gives me cold.
Indeed. Walk home? You are prettily shod for walking home. It will be bad enough for the horses.
Emma, you and Papa might follow at your leisure. I do not wish to vex you both with such a sudden departure.
It seems wise to set off directly. Perhaps we could join you.
George, where did you get to?
I went to see the snow myself. I walked beyond the sweep gate, some way along the Highbury Road, and the snow was nowhere above half an inch deep. There's hardly enough to whiten the ground in many places. Very few flakes are falling at present, but the clouds are parting. There's every appearance of it being soon over. I saw the coachman. They both agreed there's nothing to apprehend.
Oh, thank goodness. We can be at our ease again.
I cannot agree with you, my dear. There is no present danger, but it cannot be safe to stay.
Oh, but there is so little snow, and it will soon stop. Mr. Knightley has made sure it is safe on all counts, have you not?
Indeed I have, but I do not believe Mr. Woodhouse will be easy until you are all settled back at Hartfield. Shall I ring the bell for the carriages?
Yes, please do, Mr. Knightley. You are quite correct.
The bell was rung and the carriages spoken for. A few minutes more and Emma hoped to see one troublesome companion deposited in his own house to get sober and cool, and the other recover his temper and happiness when this visit of hardship were over. The carriages came, and Mr. Woodhouse, always the first object on such occasions, was carefully attended to his carriage. James was talked to and given a charge to go very slow and wait for the other carriage. Isabella stepped in after her father, and John Knightley, forgetting that he did not belong to their party, stepped in after his wife, very naturally. Emma, therefore, found, on being escorted and followed into the second carriage by Mr. Elton, that the door was to be lawfully shut on them, and that they were to have a tête-à-tête drive. She would rather it had not happened. She believed he had been drinking too much of Mr. Weston's good wine, and felt sure that he would want to be talking nonsense. To restrain him as much as might be by her own manners, she began to speak with exquisite calmness and gravity of the weather and the condition of the road.
I am sure we are quite right to be on our way. It is never wise to underestimate snow, and there is barely a star to be seen.
Miss Woodhouse.
Mr. Elton, please, let go of my hand.
I would not take your hand if I did not have something of the utmost importance to say. I must avail myself of this precious opportunity to tell you what you must already know. I adore you, Miss Woodhouse. I am ready to die if you refuse me, but I flatter myself that my ardent attachment, my unequaled love, could not fail of having some effect. In short, I am very much resolved of being accepted as soon as possible.
I am very much astonished, Mr. Elton. This to me? You forget yourself. You take me for my friend. Any message to Miss Smith that I shall be happy to deliver, but no more of this to me, if you please.
Miss Smith? Message to Miss Smith? What could you possibly mean?
Mr. Elton, this is the most extraordinary conduct. And I can account for it only in one way. You are not yourself, or you could not speak either to me or of Harriet in such a manner. Command yourself enough to say no more, and I will endeavour to forget it.
You are quite mistaken. I have only drunk wine enough to elevate my spirits, not at all to confuse my intellects. I perfectly know my own meaning and my passion for you, Miss Woodhouse. It is a fire that cannot be dimmed.
You have made yourself too clear, Mr. Elton. My astonishment is much beyond anything I can express. After such behaviour as I have witnessed during the last month to Miss Smith, such attentions as I've been in the daily habit of observing, to be addressing me in this manner. This is an unsteadiness of character indeed, which I had not supposed possible. Believe me, sir, I am far, very far from gratified in being the object of such professions.
Miss Smith? I never thought of Miss Smith in the whole course of my existence. Never paid her any attentions, but as your friend. Never cared whether she were dead or alive, but as your friend. If she has fancied otherwise, her own wishes have misled her, and I am very sorry, extremely sorry, but Miss Smith, indeed, oh, Miss Woodhouse, who can think of Miss Smith when Miss Woodhouse is near? No, upon my honour, there is no unsteadiness of character. I have thought only of you. I protest against having paid the smallest attention to anyone else. Everything that I have said or done for many weeks past has been with the sole view of marking my adoration of yourself. You cannot seriously doubt it. No, I am sure you have seen and understood me.
It would be impossible to say what Emma felt on hearing this, which of all her unpleasant sensations was uppermost. She was too completely overpowered to be immediately able to reply, and 2 moments of silence being ample encouragement for Mr. Elton's sanguine state of mind, he tried to take her hand again.
Charming Miss Woodhouse.
Mr. Elton.
Allow me to interpret this interesting silence. It confesses that you have long understood me.
No, sir, it confesses no such thing. So far from having long understood you, I have been in a most complete error with respect to your views till this moment. As to myself, I am very sorry that you should have been giving way to any feelings, for nothing could be farther from my wishes. Your attachment to my friend Harriet, your pursuit of her, as it appeared, gave me great pleasure, and I have been very earnestly wishing you success. But had I supposed that she were not your attraction to Hartfield, I should certainly have thought you judged ill in making your visits so frequent. Am I to believe that you have never sought to recommend yourself particularly to Miss Smith? That you have never thought seriously of her?
Never, madam. Never, I assure you. I think seriously of Miss Smith. Miss Smith is a very good sort of girl, and I shall be happy to see her respectably settled. I wish her extremely well, and no doubt there are men who might not object to... Everybody has their level, but as for myself, I am not, I think, quite so much at a loss. I need not so totally despair of an equal alliance as to be addressing myself to Miss Smith. No, madam. My visits to Hartfield have been for yourself only. And the encouragement I received...
Encouragement? I give you encouragement? Sir, you have been entirely mistaken in supposing it. I have seen you only as the admirer of my friend. In no other light could you have been more to me than a common acquaintance. I am exceedingly sorry, but it is well that the mistake ends where it does. Had the same behaviour continued, Miss Smith might have been led into a misconception of your views. But, as it is, the disappointment is single, and I trust will not be lasting. I have no thoughts of matrimony at present.
He was too angry to say another word, her manner too decided to invite supplication. And in this state of swelling resentment and mutually deep mortification, they had to continue together a few minutes longer, for the fears of Mr. Woodhouse had confined them to a foot pace. If there had not been so much anger, there would have been desperate awkwardness, but their straightforward emotions left no room for the little zigzags of embarrassment. Without knowing when the carriage turned into Vicarage Lane or when it stopped, they found themselves all at once at the door of his house, and he was out before another syllable passed. Emma then felt it indispensable to wish him a good night. The compliment was just returned, coldly and proudly, and under indescribable irritation of spirits, she was then conveyed to Hartfield. There, it seemed as if her return only were wanted to make everything go well. For Mr. John Knightley, ashamed of his ill-humour, was now all kindness and attention, and so particularly solicitous for the comfort of her father as to seem, if not quite ready to join him in a basin of gruel, perfectly sensible of its being exceedingly wholesome. The day was concluding in peace and comfort to all their little party, except herself. But her mind had never been in such perturbation, and it needed a very strong effort to appear attentive and cheerful till the usual hour of separating allowed her the relief of quiet reflection. The hair was curled and the maid sent away, and Emma sat down to think and be miserable. It was a wretched business indeed. Such a blow for Harriet, whom she had persuaded into liking the man. How could she have been so deceived? He protested that he had never thought seriously of Harriet. Never! She looked back as well as she could, but it was all confusion. She had taken up the idea, she supposed, and made everything bend to it. But the picture, how eager he had been about the picture, and the charade, and 100 other circumstances, how clearly they had seemed to point at Harriet. To be sure, the charade, with its ready wit and soft eyes, in fact, it suited neither. It was a jumble without taste or truth. But who could have seen through such thick-headed nonsense? Mr. Elton was proving himself in many respects the very reverse of what she had believed him. Proud, assuming, conceited, very full of his own claims, and little concerned about the feelings of others. He wanted to marry well, and having the arrogance to raise his eyes to her, pretended to be in love. But there had been no real affection either in his language or manners. He only wanted to aggrandize and enrich himself. And if Miss Woodhouse of Hartfield, the heiress of £30,000, were not quite so easily obtained as he had fancied, he would soon try for Miss somebody else with 20 or with 10. But that he should suppose himself her equal in connection or mind while looking down upon her friend, so well understanding the gradations of rank below him and be so blind to what rose above, it was most provoking. He must know that the Woodhouses had been settled for several generations at Hartfield, the younger branch of a very ancient family, and that the Eltons were nobody, and still he had fancied her in love with him. After raving a little on this point, however, Emma admitted that in encouraging his connection with Harriet, her behaviour to him had been full of courtesy and attention. Such attention that Mr. Elton might very well have fancied himself a decided favourite. If she'd so misinterpreted his feelings, she had little right to wonder that he, with self-interest to blind him, should have mistaken hers. The first error, and the worst, lay at her door. It was foolish, it was wrong, to take so active a part in bringing any two people together. It was making light of what ought to be serious, a trick of what ought to be simple. She was quite concerned and ashamed and resolved to do such things no more. Thoughts of the distressing explanation she had to make to poor Harriet and all that she would suffer were enough to occupy her some time longer. And she went to bed at last with nothing settled but the conviction of her having blundered most dreadfully. To youth and natural cheerfulness like Emma's, though under temporary gloom, the return of day will hardly fail to bring return of spirits. Emma got up on the morrow more ready to see alleviations of the evil before her and to depend upon getting tolerably out of it. It was a great consolation to know that Mr. Elton was not really in love with her, and that Harriet's nature was not of that superior sort in which the feelings are most acute and retentive. Besides, there could be no necessity for anybody's knowing what had passed except the three principals. These were very cheering thoughts, and the sight of a great deal of snow on the ground did her further service, for anything was welcome that might justify their all three being quite asunder at present. The weather remained in that unsettled state between frost and thaw, which is, of all others, the most unfriendly for exercise, every morning beginning in rain or snow, and every evening setting in to freeze, making her, for many days, a most honourable prisoner. No intercourse with Harriet was possible but by note, and no need to find excuses for Mr. Elton's absenting himself. The weather soon improved, however, enough for those to move who must move. Mr. and Mrs. John Knightley departed Hartfield, and that very evening brought a note from Mr. Elton to Mr. Woodhouse, a long, civil, ceremonious note.
Dear Mr. Woodhouse, I write with my very best compliments to declare that I am proposing to leave Highbury tomorrow morning for Bath, where, in compliance with the pressing entreaties of some friends, I've engaged to spend a few weeks. I very much regret the impossibility I am under, from various circumstances of weather and business, of taking a personal leave of you, whose friendly civilities I should ever retain a most grateful sense. Should you ever have any commands, I should be happy to attend to them. Yours ever, Mr. Elton.
Emma was most agreeably surprised. Mr. Elton's absence just at this time was the very thing to be desired. She admired him for contriving it, though not for the manner in which it was announced. Resentment could not have been more plainly spoken than in a civility to her father from which she was so pointedly excluded. She had not even a share in his opening compliments. Her name was not mentioned, and there was so striking a change in all this, as she thought at first could not escape her father's suspicion. It did, however. Her father was quite taken up with the surprise of so sudden a journey, and his fears that Mr. Elton might never get safely to the end of it, and saw nothing extraordinary in his language. Emma now resolved to keep Harriet no longer in the dark. She went to Mrs. Goddard's accordingly the very next day to undergo the necessary penance of communication.
The girls are most jealous that you're visiting me here, Miss Woodhouse.
I am afraid my visit will not bring any pleasure, Harriet.
Oh, I could never imagine that, but if there is bad news, Miss Woodhouse, do not be afraid to tell me. Perhaps I can be of help.
Harriet, I have been grossly mistaken these past 6 weeks. I have been grossly mistaken and misjudging in all my ideas on one subject. In all my observations, convictions, all my prophecies. On Christmas Eve, I discovered a wretched truth that I must share with you. Mr. Elton is not in love with you.
Oh. Yes, I see. He wishes me to throw off my ridiculous hopes and appeal to you to break the news. Oh, I suppose I've made a fool of myself.
No, my dear Harriet. You have acted with all possible grace and propriety. It is my own folly that has brought this about, and I cannot express how deeply ashamed I am.
Do not be distressed. I beg you. You are quite blameless. Mr. Elton is all perfection. He captured my heart when first I saw him. The happy hours I have spent in his company since would not have been possible without you.
But I encouraged the match, believing that he cared for you in return.
And you did so in good faith. My dear Miss Woodhouse, you do so care for everybody around you. But the hearts of others are beyond your power. You cannot make Mr. Elton care for me any more than I can.
I have been a bad friend to you, Harriet. I do not believe I can be in charity with myself again.
No, no. I have brought about the situation myself. My hopes were so excessive. He must think me ridiculous. I wish you would not shield me from it.
I am here in complete honesty, Harriet. It is the only small redemption I can hope for.
I would not add to the hurt with any deception.
How then did Mr. Elton come to tell you he did not care for me?
He made a declaration.
He is in love with you.
No, indeed, he is not. He is taken with my fortune. There was nothing genuine in his manner, and I am told, reliably so, that he is seeking a fortuitous marriage. I was misled most terribly by his compliments and gracious manners.
As was I. Oh, Miss Woodhouse.
Dear Harriet, can you ever forgive me?
There is nothing to forgive. The affection of such a man as Mr. Elton would have been too great a distinction. I never could have deserved him. And nobody but so partial and kind a friend as you would have thought it possible. I must empty my heart of all affection for him.
Emma listened to her and tried to console her with all her heart and understanding, really for the time convinced that Harriet was the superior creature of the two. She left in the certain knowledge that her second duty now, inferior only to her father's claims, was to promote Harriet's comfort and endeavour to prove her own affection in some better method than by matchmaking. She got her to Hartfield and showed her the most unvarying kindness, striving to occupy and amuse her, and by books and conversation to drive Mr. Elton from her thoughts. Time, she knew, must be allowed for this being thoroughly done, and she hoped that at Harriet's age and with the entire extinction of all hope, such a state of composure may be reached by the time of Mr. Elton's return. Harriet's return to Mrs. Goddard's, however, brought fresh pain. Mr. Elton being the adoration of all the teachers and great girls in the school, and it must be at Hartfield only that she could have any chance of hearing him spoken of with cooling moderation or repellent truth. Where the wound had been given, there must the cure be found, and Emma felt that till she saw Harriet in the way of cure, there could be no true peace for herself. The time proposed for Mr. Frank Churchill's visit drew near, but Mrs. Weston's fears were justified in the arrival of a letter of excuse, which delayed his visit to some future date. Emma was not at this time in a state of spirits to care really about Mr. Frank Churchill's not coming, except as a disappointment at Randall's. The acquaintance at present had no charm for her. But still, as it was desirable that she should appear like her usual self, she must appear to share Mr. and Mrs. Weston's disappointment. She was the first to announce it to Mr. Knightley, and decried, with all the enthusiasm necessary to play her part, the conduct of the Churchills in keeping Frank away.
I cannot call it anything but a shocking business.
The Churchills are very likely in fault, but I dare say he might come if he would.
I do not know why you should say so. He wishes exceedingly to come, but his uncle and aunt will not spare him.
I cannot believe that he has not the power of coming, if he made a point of it. It is too unlikely for me to believe it without proof.
How odd you are. What has Mr. Frank Churchill done to make you suppose him such an unnatural creature?
I am not supposing him at all an unnatural creature. It is a great deal more natural than one could wish, that a young man brought up by those who are proud, luxurious, and selfish should be proud, luxurious, and selfish too. If Frank Churchill had wanted to see his father, he would have contrived it between September and January. A man at his age cannot be without the means of doing as much as that. It is impossible. We know, on the contrary, he is forever at some watering place or other. A little while ago we heard he was at Weymouth, and this proves that he can leave the Churchills.
Yes, sometimes he can.
And those times are whenever he thinks it worth his while, whenever there is any temptation of pleasure.
It is very unfair to judge of anybody's conduct without an intimate knowledge of their situation.
There is one thing, Emma, which a man can always do if he chooses, and that is his duty. It is Frank Churchill's duty to pay this attention to his father. He knows it to be so by his promises and messages. He should say at once, simply and resolutely to Mrs. Churchill, that such duty must take precedence even to her convenience. If he would say so to her at once in the tone of decision becoming a man, there would be no opposition made to his going.
Oh, the difference of situation and habit. I wish you would try to understand what an amiable young man may be likely to feel in directly opposing those whom, as child and boy, he has been looking up to all his life.
Our amiable young man is a very weak young man, if this be the first occasion of his carrying through a resolution to do right against the will of others. It ought to have been a habit with him by this time to follow his duty instead of consulting expediency. I can allow for the fears of the child, but not of the man.
Oh, we shall never agree about him, but that is nothing extraordinary. I have not the least idea of his being a weak young man. I feel sure that he is not.
He can sit down and write a fine, flourishing letter full of professions and falsehoods, but it is only to preserve peace at home and prevent his father's having any right to complain. His letters disgust me.
You seem determined to think ill of him.
Me? Not at all. I do not want to think ill of him. I should be as ready to acknowledge his merits, but I hear of none, except what are merely personal, that he is well-grown and good-looking, with smooth, plausible manners.
Well, if he has nothing else to recommend him, he will be a treasure at Highbury. We do not often look upon fine young men, well-bred and agreeable. We must not ask for all the virtues into the bargain. Cannot you imagine, Mr. Knightley, what a sensation his coming will produce? There will be but one subject throughout the parishes of Donwell and Highbury, but one object of curiosity. It will be all Mr. Frank Churchill. We shall think and speak of nobody else.
You will excuse my being so much overpowered. If I find him conversable, I shall be glad of his acquaintance, but if he is only a chattering coxcomb, he will not occupy much of my time or thought.
I will say no more about him. You turn everything to evil. We are both prejudiced, you against, I for him, and we have no chance of agreeing till he is really here.
Emma immediately talked of something else, though she could not comprehend why Mr. Knightley should be so angry. To take a dislike to a young man only because he appeared to be of a different disposition from himself was unworthy the real liberality of mind which she was always used to acknowledge in him. The following morning, Harriet arrived at Hartfield to remain for several days. Emma did all she was capable of to soothe, support, and cheer the friend she had led into such a grave disappointment. Emma and Harriet had been walking together one morning, and, in Emma's opinion, had been talking enough of Mr. Elton for that day. She could not think that Harriet's solace or her own sins required more, and she was therefore industriously getting rid of the subject as they returned. After speaking some time of what the poor must suffer in winter, Emma at last believed she had succeeded. But when she received no other answer than a very plaintive, "Mr. Elton is so good to the poor," she found something else must be done. They were just approaching the house where lived Mrs. and Miss Bates. She determined to call upon them and seek safety in numbers, although she seldom went near them if it could be helped. They were most tiresome women, and visiting them put Emma in danger of falling in with the second-rate and third-rate of Highbury who were calling on them forever. But now she made the sudden resolution of not passing their door without going in, observing, as she proposed it to Harriet, that, as well as she could calculate, they were just now quite safe from any letter from Jane Fairfax. The house belonged to people in business. Mrs. and Miss Bates occupied the drawing-room floor, and there, in the very moderate-sized apartment, which was everything to them, the visitors were most cordially welcomed.
Such a pleasure, Miss Woodhouse. Miss Smith, so kind of you to visit. Are your shoes damp? How is Mr. Woodhouse?
Very well, I thank you.
Oh, I am so glad. Mother is quite well, you see.
You are quite well, aren't you, Mother?
Yes. Will you have a piece of sweet cake? Mrs. Cole was just here. She had just called in for 10 minutes and had been so good as to sit an hour with us. She had taken a piece of cake and been so kind as to say she liked it very much, and therefore I hope you would do us the favour to eat a piece too.
Thank you. I'm sure it is delicious.
I am glad. Here we are.
Mrs. Cole was so kind as to sit some time with us, talking of Jane. For as soon as she came in, she began inquiring after her. Jane is so very great a favourite there. We had a letter this very morning.
Have you heard from Miss Fairfax so lately? I am extremely happy. I hope she is well.
Thank you. You are so kind. Right. Here it is. I was sure it could not be far off. Since you are so kind as to wish to hear what she says, but first of all, I really must, in justice to Jane, apologise for her writing so short a letter. Only 2 pages, you see. Hardly 2. And in general, she fills the whole paper and crosses half. My mother often wonders that I can make it out so well. I am sure she would contrive to make it out herself, if she had nobody to do it for her. And, indeed, though my mother's eyes are not so good as they were, she can see amazingly well still, thank God, with the help of spectacles. Is not that true, Mother? Oh, it is a blessing.
Miss Fairfax's handwriting is excellent. I have always thought so.
Oh, you are extremely kind. You, who are such a judge, and write so beautifully yourself. My mother does not hear. She's a little deaf, you know. Mother! Do you hear what Miss Woodhouse is so obliging to say about Jane's handwriting? She says it is excellent. Excellent! Jane's handwriting. Yes! My mother's deafness is very trifling, you see. By only raising my voice and saying anything 2 or 3 times over, she is sure to hear, but then she is used to my voice. But it is very remarkable that she should always hear Jane better than she does me. Jane speaks so distinct. However, she will not find her grandmama at all deafer than she was 2 years ago, which is saying a great deal at my mother's time of life. And it really is full 2 years, you know, since she was here. We never were so long without seeing her before, and as I was telling Mrs. Cole, we shall hardly know how to make enough of her now.
Are you expecting Miss Fairfax soon?
Oh, yes. Next week.
Indeed. That must be a very great pleasure.
Thank you. You are very kind. Yes, next week. That is what she writes about. That is the reason for her writing out of rule, as we call it. In the common cause, we should not have heard from her before next Tuesday or Wednesday.
Yes, so I imagined. I was afraid there could be little chance of my hearing anything of Miss Fairfax today.